There's a number that turns up every so often in the kind of conversation programmers have when they are bored and a little proud and want to gesture at the strangeness of what they do. The number is 36 million. If you open a terminal on Linus Torvalds' workstation in his home in Portland, Oregon, and you type a small command that walks through every C source file and every header file in the Linux operating system, and you ask the computer to count up the lines, the number that comes back is in the neighborhood of 36 million. 36 million lines, every one of them a sequence of characters a human being once sat down and typed. The operating system that runs roughly 95% of the world's cloud servers, every Android phone in every pocket, every modern Tesla, the laptops aboard the International Space Station, the little helicopter that flew over the Martian sand a few years back, is, when you reduce it to what it actually is, a very large quantity of text. You could print it out. You would fill a stadium with the pages. You could, if you wanted to, sit on a bench in that stadium and read it slowly, line by line, in any text editor you have on your laptop, the same text editor you might use to write an email or a grocery list. It is not encrypted. It is not hidden. It is not stored in some proprietary binary format, known only to a priesthood of engineers. It is, in the most literal sense, just letters and digits and punctuation, sitting in files on disk, available to anybody patient enough to look. When Linus first sent that operating system out into the world in the fall of 1991, it was about 10,000 lines. A single evening's reading. A small idea, written down. 30-some years later, that small idea has grown into the 36 million, contributed by 15,000 individual developers, working at 1,500 separate companies, coordinated through a single mailing list and a single piece of code that one man in Portland still personally curates. And all of it, every line, is text. This is Rust, gently. A patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 18. Source code as artifact. Today I want to give you a feeling for what software actually is when you peel back all the cleverness, all the running animations and clicking buttons and humming servers, and you go down to what is sitting on the hard drive. By the end of this 15 minutes, you will know what a source file is, what a programmer ships when they ship a change, why text won over every fancy alternative that try to replace it, and why this matters for how software gets built, including the software you may end up writing yourself someday, with a little patience. Let me take a moment to set this up properly, because the picture is so plain that it can be hard to believe. When you use an app on your phone, when you load a web page, when you ask a voice assistant for the weather, what is happening, mechanically, is that a sequence of instructions that some person or some team of people wrote down on a keyboard years ago or months ago or this morning is being read and executed by the chip inside the device in your hand. Those instructions, before they got translated into the language of the chip, were written in a programming language, which is to say, they were written as text. Typed letters, pressed keys, a long file on a disk, somewhere. A human read it back, edited it, saved it, sent it to a colleague. The colleague suggested a change. The change was made. Eventually, the file became part of a product, which became part of your day. There is no other layer to it. There is no magic process by which programmers conjure software into existence through gesture or thought. They sit, they type, they save, they share. Every time. Now, your existing intuition for this is closer than you might think. You have, in your life, opened a text file. You have written a recipe down. You have written a note for a friend, or a list of things to pack for a trip, or instructions for a babysitter on how to feed the cat. Every one of those is a sequence of characters meant to be read and acted on by somebody else. A source file is exactly that. The only difference is the reader. The reader, in the case of source code, is a piece of software called a compiler, or a piece of software called an interpreter, and we will meet both of those properly next time. For today, just hold the picture in your head. A source file is a written instruction for a reader who will follow it precisely. Let's look at one. Just in our imagination. Open a folder on a programmer's laptop, the kind of folder that holds the Linux operating system, and look at the first file the operating system runs when a computer turns on. The file is called main, with a tiny suffix at the end that signals it is written in the C programming language, the suffix .c. If you opened it in a normal text editor, you would see, near the top, a long comment block, written in plain English, explaining what the file is for. Below it, function definitions. Inside one of those functions, there is a line that, in slightly Englishy form, says start the kernel now. It is a name. It is a label for a piece of work. A few lines below that, the work itself, in carefully chosen words from a small vocabulary that the C compiler will understand. You could read it. You would not understand every word the first time, but you could read it. There is nothing hidden behind the page. What sits underneath that file, what is actually on the disk, is even simpler than the words suggest. A source file is at the lowest level, a long sequence of bytes, each one a small number between 0 and 255. For decades, the agreed-upon convention was a coding scheme called ASCII, finalized in 1968, where each byte stood for 128 characters, the letters of the English alphabet, the digits, the standard punctuation, and a handful of special control codes for tab and newline. Modern files use a slightly more capable scheme called UTF-8, designed by Ken Thompson and Rob Pike on a placemat in New Jersey Diner in September of 1992, which can represent every character in every human writing system, plus emoji, while remaining fully compatible with the older ASCII. A C source file, a Rust file with the suffix dot, or S, a Python file with the suffix .py, a Markdown file with the suffix .md, are all underneath the same kind of thing. Bytes, new lines, tabs. You can open any of them in any plain text editor you have. The unit of work in this world, the thing programmers actually ship to each other, is not the whole file, and it is not the whole program. It is something smaller called a diff. A diff is the difference between the file before and the file after a change. Imagine you and a friend are co-writing a novel, and you want to suggest a small edit, the way you might rearrange one paragraph and replace a word. Instead of sending the whole novel back, you send a tiny annotated note that says, take out this sentence, put in this one, change this word from cold to chilly. That note is a diff. The format of these notes was invented at Bell Labs in 1976 by a man named Doug McElroy, working with a colleague named Hunt, and the format has barely changed since. Programmers spend most of their working lives reading and writing diffs. A career, in a sense, is a long stream of diffs. This is why text won. There are other ideas. Through the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s, every few years somebody would announce that the future of programming was visual, that you would draw boxes on a screen and drag arrows between them and never have to type a line of code again. Some of these tools became popular in specific corners. A visual environment called LabVIEW from 1986 found a real home in scientific instrumentation. A children's environment called Scratch from 2003 taught a generation of kids the basics of programming logic. A whole genre of so-called no-code tools in the 20-teens promised to put software building in the hands of anyone with a browser. Most of them stayed in their corners. The reason is mundane. Diffs only work on text. Searching only works on text. Two engineers, six time zones apart, can both edit the same file in the morning, and the system can merge their changes automatically in the afternoon, because text has a stable canonical form. Pictures cannot do that. The picture from one person and the picture from the other person cannot be combined by a machine that does not understand pictures. Text can be combined. Text can be emailed. Text can be pasted into a chat window. Text is the universal interface, as a Bell Labs engineer named Doug McElroy wrote in a memo in 1978, and the entire culture of software has been built on that one observation. McElroy's memo, sometimes called the Unix philosophy, contained a short list of principles. Write programs that do one thing and do it well. Write programs to work together. Write programs to handle text streams, because that is a universal interface. Those three sentences, in that order, are the closest the field has to a credo. They are why a working programmer can sit down at a terminal and string together a chain of small tools, each reading text in and writing text out, with each one piping its output to the next, the way you might pipe water through a series of filters. The whole skill, once you know the pieces, looks like a kind of fluency in plumbing. Now, what does this mean for the world of products you use every day? It means that the software running your bank, your hospital, your car, your phone is fundamentally inspectable, at least by anyone who has access to the source. It means that fixing a bug in one of the largest systems on Earth might amount to a three-line change in a single file, proposed in a politely worded note, reviewed by other engineers, and accepted within an hour. It means that the history of how a piece of software grew, every decision, every reversal, every late-night frustration, is sitting somewhere as a stream of text changes with the name of the person who made each one and the moment in time they made it. There is a command called git blame, and if you point it at any line in a source file in any modern project, it will tell you who wrote that line, when, and what they said about it. Every line, including the one that crashed your phone last week. And it means that the act of contributing to even the largest software in the world is, in principle, available to a 13-year-old with a laptop and patience. The Linux kernel is 6 gigabytes of text. A 13-year-old can download it, read it, find a typo, propose a correction, and have that correction accepted into the operating system that runs much of the planet by emailing a polite, well-formatted diff to the right mailing list. People have done this. They keep doing it. It is part of what makes this culture, when it is at its best, genuinely remarkable. The companies whose names you know are, in this respect, no different from the 13-year-old. Apache, the web server that for a decade ran more than half the websites in the world, started as a small group of engineers in 1995 trading patches to a piece of software written by a graduate student at the University of Illinois. The name was a joke. They were Apache server. The whole thing was, in his text, SQLite, a small database written by one careful engineer named Richard Hipps starting in the year 2000, is about 150,000 lines of C, sitting in a single source file, and it runs inside every iPhone, every Android phone, every web browser, and the avionic suites of several models of commercial airliner. It is in the public domain. Anyone can read it. Many people have. Redis, a database written by an Italian engineer named Salvatore Sanfilippo in a Sicilian flat in 2009 to scale his startup's analytics, was 3,000 lines of C in its first version, finished in a week, and now sits inside an enormous fraction of the websites you use. Rust itself, the language this show is named after, is exactly the same kind of thing. A folder of files on disk. Plain text. You can read it. So, three things to carry away. First, source code is just text. Letters and digits and punctuation and files on disk, openable in any editor you already have. Nothing hidden, nothing magical. Second, programmers do not ship code. They ship diffs, which are small, careful changes to that text, proposed and reviewed and accepted one at a time. Third, text won the war over every prettier alternative because text is the only artifact that you can compare, merge, search, email, and pass between strangers across time and distance without ever losing fidelity. Next time on Rust, gently, we will follow a single file of text as it becomes a real running program. We will meet the compiler properly, watch the 6 stages of its work, and learn why a piece of software called LLVM sits quietly behind almost every modern language, including Rust. Until then, take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.